It's time for TWiT this week in tech. Big show for you. Christina Warren's here, Alex Lindsay, Rafe Needleman, and I'm back. We're going to talk about Google. Did you notice on Friday? Just a little bit of an increase in the stock price. We'll also talk about their new beacon technology. We'll talk about the planet Pluto, 600 baud modems, and a whole lot more. You stay tuned. TWiT is next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is TWiT, This Week in Tech, episode 519, recorded Sunday, July 19th, 2015. Bad news drones. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Lynda.com, the online learning platform with over 3,000 on-demand video courses to help you strengthen your business, technology, and creative skills. For a free 10-day trial, visit lynda.com/twit2. That's lynda.com/twit and the number 2. And by Gazelle, the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. Find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products is worth at gazelle.com. And by FreshBooks, the super simple cloud accounting and invoicing solution designed to help small business owners save time billing and get paid faster. Try it free at freshbooks.com/twit. And by GoToMeeting from Citrix, the powerfully simple way to meet with coworkers and clients from the convenience of your computer, smartphone, or tablet. Share the same screen and see each other face-to-face with HD video conferencing. For a 30-day free trial, visit GoToMeeting.com today. It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech, the show where we cover the latest tech news. I'm so glad to be back, but I want to thank the folks who filled in for me. Becky Worley, who did a great job. Mike Elgin, who did a great job. And, yeah, Jason Calacanis, who did a great job, I hear. I haven't seen either of any of those shows. I'm glad to be back. And thank you to all three of you for hosting while I've been gone. We got a great panel for you, starting with Christina Warren from Mashable. Hi, Christina.
Hey, Leo, what's going on?
At Film Girl.
Yes.
Always good to see you. Also great to see Alex Lindsay. We haven't seen a lot of on MacBreak Weekly. I'm really glad to get you in from the Pixel Core.
See, at first I'm gone and then I'm everywhere.
I want you to be everywhere because you're the greatest. Are you in Pittsburgh right now?
I'm in Pittsburgh for today.
Yeah. He's got the best setup in the middle of nowhere in Pennsylvania. I mean, you look better than I do, and I'm in studio. I don't know how you do it. It's pretty impressive.
Smoke and mirrors.
And with a brand new job, my old buddy Rafe Needleman is here.
Hi, Leo.
Rafe, of course, for many years you were at CNET.
Yes.
And then you went to Evernote.
Yes.
For a brief flirtation with the dark side.
Year and a half. It was actually pretty fun.
Yeah.
They have cookies.
I guess Phil Lyman's moving himself upstairs now at Evernote. They have a new guy going to be in charge.
Do they?
I thought so.
I read that story. I know nothing more than what I've read in the story.
Then went to Yahoo Tech, turned that into the number 4 tech site on the internet.
Yep.
Which I hear is a pretty big thing now.
The internet, yeah.
Huge.
Mm-hmm. Yep. It's becoming a thing.
And now you've taken your talents and you've moved on to Maker Media. We love Make Magazine.
Oh, it's so fun.
Dale Dougherty and the gang, and you're editor-in-chief at Maker Media, which means not only the magazine, but the books, the Maker Fairs, which are huge. How many Maker Fairs are there now?
There are a couple of big ones, San Francisco and New York.
Yep.
And all told, 150 around the world.
That's what's so cool.
I know.
Wow.
They're everywhere.
It's a movement.
People put them on by themselves, and it's just awesome.
It's a movement,
yeah.
Which is really neat. Did anything happen while I was gone at all? Reddit's been good.
Great site.
Love
really,
them.
Well, let's not do anything because Leo's.
I hear that Windows Phone's going great.
Yeah.
That's good news.
It's on fire. It is on fire. Well, okay, it is. But
let me ask you, because I'm in Germany when iOS 8.4 comes out, and I am very slow bandwidth. But so I worked as hard as I could to get Apple Music.
Yeah.
I'm in Austria. I finally got it. I'm starting to listen. I'm going, this is not so good. And then, unfortunately, it's not available in Hungary. What do we think about Apple Music now, 2 weeks in?
I love Spotify. I got it. I updated it. I was like, okay, whatever. Now that I'm not doing product reviews like that, I'm sticking with Spotify.
I love Spotify, too, especially since Spotify broadcasts all of our Twit programming, which is nice. That's a new feature. Yeah. I think Spotify wisely realized that depending on music labels for your business is probably a long-term, not a great plan.
Yep.
So they've added content from podcasts, and I think that's nice, and other internet programming, including video. But
I think right now I still find Apple Music a little confusing. You know, just there's a lot there.
People don't even know. They think it's what is it? Is it iTunes? Is it what is it?
Yeah, unfortunately, that's the biggest problem is that it's at least on the desktop, it's built into the iTunes app. I feel like what they should do at some point is do what they did with the Photos app and do what they've done with some of the other things and separate it out. So if you want to have iTunes as your kind of, you know, media management place to, you know, get files on your iPhone and do updates and that stuff, that's fine. But separate all of the Apple Music stuff into its own app. The interface, there's a lot there. You know, they've got a lot going on. But I find the For You section to be fantastic. I love Spotify. I've been a Spotify user since, I think, 2 years before it officially came to the United States.
Is there anything Apple Music does that Spotify doesn't do?
Yes, the recommendations are significantly, significantly better on Apple Music, I find. Okay. I find the For You section is really good. I think that a lot of the curated playlists they make are a lot better than the curated playlists Spotify makes. That said, I do miss being able to search for playlists that other people have created. So if I want to see that someone, you know, made a playlist of all the songs in Mad Men, I can do that on Spotify. I can't do that on Apple Music. But I do find the recommendations I get from Apple Music of what to listen to, what new artists are coming out, things that I might like, deep cuts from artists that maybe I haven't listened to in a while. I find that to be a lot better. I like Beats One. I don't mind the radio station. I don't love all the day-to-day programming, not that I have to, but I like a lot of the shows that they have.
They have an Elton John show and stuff. Every time I listen to Beats One, Alex, you're a former DJ, as am I. I feel like this is radio from the 70s. They have, Beats One, echo, 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 echo. Really? And the DJs will talk over music like crazy. It just seems retro to me, and I wonder
it's very retro. I kind of dig that. I don't know. I mean, I think that's kind of cool. I think for a certain generation of people, they're either going to love it or hate it. But there are certain people who are listening to it now who've never listened to traditional radio the way that, you know, it used to be around, because
that's what this is, isn't it?
Programmatic so long ago. It is. It's traditional.
And Mike Elgin made a point that's for the first time ever there is a global radio station that conceivably people from all over there's 100 countries all over the world could be listening. And you break a song on Beats One, you're breaking it. Not just in the U.S., but everywhere. And so it could be very powerful. And yet, I don't feel like one station is going to serve a very broad, heterogeneous audience.
I'm supposed to start listening to radio again.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Apple brought it back.
All right.
Just for you.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that though.
Yeah, I'm not. Based on that, I'm not convinced.
One station has been serving at least the U.S. because, I mean, when you look at Clear Channel or many of these other
this one station, isn't it?
Programming, one station.
Programming has been very, very, and there's another handful of consultants that run most of the stations in the United States. There's probably four or five real stations that cover most of the major markets, and then there's lots of little independents. And so we you know, that homogeny is I think happened for a while. I think that it is interesting though that, and I think that becomes very complex when you look at Apple possibly paying for creating content, and do they break content that they've helped make with the artists down the road? You know,
worry about is the payola thing. That it's one thing if Zane Lowe and the other Julie Antonuga and the other DJs are playing music they really love that they picked. It's another thing if Apple corporate says, "Hey, we really want to push the latest U2 album. Would you mind playing a little more of that?" That would bug me a little bit. And there's no reason to think they're doing
that.
Yeah,
I don't think they're going to do that. No, I mean, I asked Trent Reznor about that in the lead up to Apple Music, and you know, he made it very clear that the whole reason they were doing it was his idea. He wanted to basically go back to a time when, you know, radio, when DJs really kind of had authority to pick what they wanted. And Zane's show on the BBC on Radio 1 was very similar to what his show is on Apple Music. And I like that show. It's not for everybody, but I like that show. And so I think that he's basically, Trent told me, he's like kind of the heart and soul. He's like the entire kind of the DNA of Beats One is Zane. So I would be concerned if I guess what I'm saying is I'm not expecting to see that sort of interference. I would be concerned with that possibility. If I would be concerned if Zane left, let's put it that way. If Zane left, then that would be a concerning thing. But as long as he's there, I have a feeling like he's there to do his thing. And Apple is kind of treating this like a loss leader in some cases. I don't think they're looking to make money off of Beats One. They're looking as this as kind of a value add to the rest of the service.
The only reason I bring it up, I feel like it might be a little bit of an insight into Jimmy Iovine, Trent Reznor, and Apple's attitude towards music. I thought Apple killed radio. I thought Apple
that was
killed
kind of
music
the idea,
radio,
wasn't
right?
It?
The iPod came out, and now we can listen to what we want to listen to. And I thought that, and I know it was bad for music radio.
Mm-hmm.
And it's strange that they would be bringing it back. It seems like
one of the things I think is missing, though, is I think that they could kill radio. And what I mean by that is that I think we do like listening to a little bit of context around the music that we're watching or listening to.
Right.
So I think that there is an opportunity for that. I think that the real hard thing that Apple's trying to do is all these curations. But I feel like that top-down approach to all that curation and that real press to not allow the kind of cross-pollination among the users in the same way that you have Spotify, you know, to make sure that there's no, you know, noise, I guess, I feel like is going to make it a little sterile. I think that there's a lot of opportunity opportunity for people to bubble up. And I think this is the place that Spotify could actually, you know, take advantage of this, is really providing a platform. Right now, no one can do a radio station online because of the expense of all the royalties that are connected to it.
Right.
But if you combine the ability to talk a little bit as well as run songs, not actually play them and stream them, but utilize playlists that are kind of part of that process, it would allow people to start building basically their own radio stations, and that I think would definitely be the end of radio. Not because some kid in Iowa would do it, but guys like Mike Holleran and could do his own
guys
radio
who really
station.
Know what they're doing. Yeah.
Out of 91X, and do it out of his house and probably make a lot more money than he's making at the radio station.
Well, the jury's still out. We'll see. Everybody right now is for free, 3 months free.
Mm-hmm.
The real question will happen at the end of the 3 months: how many people will stick around?
It's one of those things where you put in your credit card and then they start billing you, right?
Yeah.
So I haven't.
Yeah, but you can turn it off.
There's
a button. But you have to remember.
No. You can go in advance. Like now you can go in and turn it off in the settings. Don't auto-renew. So turn off the auto-renew feature now. You'll still get it for 3 months.
I got to remember to do that. I forgot. I got to remember to do that.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
We were telling people before we figured out that joke, we were saying, use Siri to set a reminder. remind me on X date to cancel Apple Music. Well, that's what I did with HBO Now, because I pay for HBO, so I get HBO Go. But I was trying out the HBO Now service, and it was one of those things where, like, I literally made a Siri reminder. I was like, remind me on May 29th, or whatever day it was, to cancel HBO Now. So.
Let's take a little break. I want to come back. I'm not going to leave Apple because I don't understand it. They released new iPods. It baffles me. It baffles me, but Christina, as you got them, you can explain.
Yep.
The reason why I need a gold iPod Touch.
I can try.
There's got to be a reason Apple did this. This is baffling to me, but we'll talk in just a moment. Our show today brought to you by Lynda.com, the online learning platform with over 3,000 video courses. And you know what's great? You pay once. A monthly fee is very affordable, and you get access to everything. So you don't have to decide now what you want to learn. It's the way I think the human brain works. You like to dibble and dabble and dip into something and then maybe say, oh, no, I'm going to really learn Lightroom, and you go boom into it. A lot of people want to learn how to code or develop apps. You don't need to go to an expensive college to do that. You can do that at lynda.com. Listen to some of the development course. PHP with MySQL Essential Training. Okay, that's old-fashioned. How about essential training for developing Android apps? There's a new course on building data-driven apps with iOS. We've talked about Code Clinic. I love the Code Clinic. It's a multi-course series. Lynda.com's great experts, great teachers, look at common code challenges and then offer their solutions in a variety of languages, C++, C#, Java, PHP, Python, Ruby. It's so cool. They've got four new entries, JavaScript, C, R, which I've been dying to learn, and Swift, which is the hot new Apple language. Lynda, LYNDA.com. Whether it's photography, computer programming, using Microsoft Word, business skills like preparing a resume, negotiating a better deal, it's all there. You're learning from the experts. These are great teachers, but first and foremost, they're working in the field. Thousands of courses. You learn at your own pace. They're structured. You can watch them from beginning to end or just a little bit at a time. depending on your desires. You can use those course transcripts to find the part you're looking at and skip right to that. Take notes as you go. Refer to them later. They're all stored with your account. Download tutorials and watch them on the go on iOS or Android. That's nice. Get on the plane and learn a little something before you land. LYNDA.com/twit. And the number 2 will get you a free 10-day trial. So you don't even have to guess. You can see what they've got. The run of the place for 10 days. More than 3,000 on-demand video courses. And it's very affordable, as you can see. LYNDA.com/twit and the number 2. But pay nothing for your free 10-day trial right now. Lynda.com/twit and the number 2. The last thing in the world I thought I'd see is a new iPod. I thought, am I... Is this news from 1999?
You don't have kids.
That's
what
right.
You give your kids.
So is that who this is for?
That's what I'm thinking about.
So what I'm impressed is the new iPod Touch is essentially everything that the iPhone 6 is, including the camera, including the A8 processor, although it's underclocked. It's at 1.1.
It's underclocked. It's 1 gigahertz, not 1.4. Yeah. Smaller screen, no Touch ID, no Apple Pay. But the bits of it are basically the same. It's great.
It's kind of if you want to give your kid a phone, but you don't want to have to pay the data.
Right, because they're on Wi-Fi all the time.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So that's who this is for?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's that. And, I mean, you can get it in 128 gigabytes, which is actually compelling to the few people who are still, like, iPod classical.
I still have my classic.
I do, too.
Yeah.
But, I mean, because 128 gigabytes, okay, that's on 160, but it's solid-state storage, and it's going to be faster, and that's getting you a lot closer. Plus, you know, you have access to a web browser, 802.11ac, you know, Wi-Fi.
Don't we every quarter, doesn't Apple like say, oh yeah, nobody bought the iPod this quarter either?
Yeah, basically.
Which is
why I was shocked that they released the update. I mean,
when's the last time there was a new iPod?
October of 2012.
She knows that.
Of course she does.
Yeah.
She's Christina Warren. And it says so right here in her article on Mashable.com.
Oh, there you go. Okay.
Well, that's you. Here's what's scarier. The last time, so the Shuffle and the iPod Nano were also, they were not updated. They were given new colors. The Shuffle has not been touched since 2010.
Wow.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah.
So is it really, I mean, they did update other ones, but it's really about the new Touch.
Oh, no. They updated the colors on the other ones. That's all they did. They literally updated the colors. They added nothing else. So it's still the same Shuffle from 2010, still the same Nano from 2012. But now you can get them in gold, space gray, silver, product red, blue. The blue is actually really cool, and pink.
Is there evidence that people are buying iPods?
I mean, look, I think that enough of them are obviously buying them for
Does
them
your
to
son? How old's your son?
He's 9.
He's the candidate. Does he have one?
Not yet.
Would you buy him a new one?
Or would you get him an iPod Touch? I mean,
or your old phone.
He uses my old phone.
Yeah,
that's his iPod Touch.
Right.
Yeah, and it's got no cellular on it, and it's just it's a Wi-Fi device.
Nothing wrong with
it. My kids are 5 and 7, and there's nothing better on a plane is either an iPad or an iPod Touch. And so I think that and we use them a lot as utilities. So within the company, there's a lot of places I don't necessarily want to pay for a phone, and I don't want to pay for the connections, but we use them as little displays for time. Communication. There's all kinds of utilization. I mean, we have a lot of these.
But how much is a 128 gigabyte? Gold iPod Touch is what, $400?
Yeah.
Well, I don't mean that. I mean, for most people, actually, other than people who really want to replace their 160 gig solution, a 16 or a 32 is fine. As a great little addition that you're adding all of that to, it's a really great little device.
All right. I mean, they know their business. Obviously, they've done some research and they've figured that people would buy this.
I mean, the only thing I can figure is that they already have, the guts to go inside an iPhone 6, maybe pare things down a little bit. You've already got all these shells.
It's cheap to make.
Exactly. You've already got the shells and the screens. Go ahead and pop the upgrade in. Right. This will at least get iOS 9. I was actually a little concerned that maybe the old iPod Touch wouldn't get iOS 9. So this will at least get it to iOS 9. What I'm also thinking, and I don't know how likely this is, but I'd love to hear you guys' thoughts. I don't know if there's potential here for developing countries where people still have poor cell signal and are primarily using their phones, again, like most of us do on Wi-Fi, if having a $200, no contract type of device running an A8 chip and having, a better graphics performance running the latest stuff, if that could be a competitor of sorts to, you know, some of the super cheap Android phones.
That sounds like a bit of a stretch. I mean, it makes sense financially in some ways, but with super cheap Android or even, you know, Firefox, Mozilla phones, you could get all the same stuff with cellular if you want it.
That's true.
Yeah.
Could you? I mean, it does, though. I mean, I think there's an interesting theory here because Apple does not want to make and will never make probably a cheap iPhone. That's just not something they're interested in. Maybe that's what this is. I mean, you could put Skype on it if you had internet access.
Well, you have FaceTime right now. And the thing is that you can put FaceTime, Skype, GoToMeeting, Hangouts, you know, all of those things are all available on it.
You need cell service if you can get Wi-Fi. And as Wi-Fi spreads, I don't know. Maybe that's a nutty idea.
I personally think that part of this is a little bit of a hobby on Apple's part. Every update seems to make it easier to make voice calls without a cell service.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's one of those things that they just keep on kind of creeping along. They're not making any announcements.
They don't want to get anybody's dander up.
The equipment iPod Touch is a perfect safe place to do this.
And the hardware that goes into this is fully amortized. I mean, they've got the screens. The chips are probably binned versions of the AH that didn't pass the test to get into the iPhone.
That's why they're underclocked. Yeah.
Yeah. So it probably costs them very little to put this product together, and they've got to keep it updated just if they haven't updated in so long, just to keep it current.
Curtis B. in our chat room points out it does have the M8 chip, so it could do the fitness tracking.
Yeah. Right.
So it's a fitness device, perhaps. It has to have something to do with the release of Apple Music, right? Because
it's totally
an Apple Music device.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, no. I mean, that was even when I had my, on background phone call with them about the device. I mean, that was definitely a highlight of working with Apple Music.
And
what's interesting is that the Shuffle and the Nano will not work with any of the offline files you download from Apple Music if you're not an iTunes Match person. So if you've bought, if you can download tracks to listen to offline with Apple Music, those offline tracks have DRM that do not work on the iPod Touch or the iPod Nano or the iPod Shuffle. They work on the Touch just fine.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
So that's the smarter chip allows you to do that.
I guess so. I have no idea. I mean, I guess because they haven't updated the other two iPods in so many years, it can't handle the new version of DRM they've put on. Yeah. But it's weird.
Huh. And I know I use one of them in my car because I don't really want to connect my car to my phone. You know, I'm using my phone for other things.
I keep my classic in my car.
With
Spotify, it's kind of everything you'd ever want. I don't know how XM and Sirius stay in business.
I have Sirius in my car. I never use it. And I'll say this for the Sirius, anybody who works with Sirius who's listening, the audio quality,
at least in my
car, blows chunks. Man, it's awful. They want me to pay extra for that.
And then you put on Spotify, you feel like, oh my God, the sound, I feel like I'm listening to real music.
Yeah.
Because it's heavily compressed. That's why, by the way.
I have to think that Sirius and XM, they get a lot of their customers kind of the same way that AOL still keeps customers. So you buy the car and they give you like the free year or the free 6 months of the XM or Sirius or whatever. And you forget to cancel. So you just wind up getting charged again. Yeah. I mean, that's why my mom still ends up paying for satellite radio that she never really uses.
Yeah. You'd be crazy. Of course, Neil Young this week pulled all his music. From
all
Spotify.
The streaming services. And all the streaming services.
And all of them.
Here's what's interesting. He says because the audio quality is terrible.
Right.
Yet he will still sell them on iTunes.
Which is the same quality, right? 320 kilobit AAC.
I apologize in advance. Editors, you're going to have to bleep me here. It's bullshit. It's total bullshit. He's saying that it's an audio quality issue. It's not an audio quality issue. If it was an audio quality issue, then you'd also pull it from iTunes. It's clearly about money and pushing Pono in some way. I don't know.
You know, that's what makes perfect sense, except for the fact that nobody who tests the Pono versus an iPhone can tell the difference.
No, they can't. No. David Pogue, your former colleague, did like the definitive video on that. We didn't even do a video because we realized we finally Pono would not send once. We had to buy our own. We were trying to do a video doing like the A-B testing. We were like, we can't do this. David Pogue did the ultimate video. But the Pono player, can I just say that's the worst device I've used
in years.
Oh, I love
my Pono. I love it. I bought it.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Why?
I'll completely argue with both of you on that. There's a huge difference. In fact, and I'm waiting because we had Neil Young on Triangulation. He showed off there's going to be an app on the next firmware update that will allow you to listen to the same song in a variety of different formats. You can listen to the native Pono version in 128 kilobit, 256 kilobit. And I think that will be the final test. That's
demo
really
mode.
How you have to do it because the levels have to be the same.
It has got to be the same.
The way Pogue did it is a joke.
Oh, okay, man.
That's a joke. No, that's not, you know, here, listen on an iPhone. Okay, now listen on a phone.
No, it's not how he did it. That's not how he did it. It was a blind test with the same headphones in a switcher with the audio levels equalized.
Okay. It's a joke.
Not a joke.
I can hear the difference.
Very serious.
There's a big difference. And why would you? You can make the argument, and I think that's a legitimate argument, the difference between a CD and a high-res file. There you can make an argument. No one can make the argument that AAC or MP3, heavily compressed, lossy compression music sounds as good as uncompressed music. That's just not the case.
It doesn't.
Technically, you can't make that argument. When you're listening to most people's headphones,
idiots. They have little white headphones.
No,
not the problem.
No, they're using those crappy Beats over the ears things.
Well, they can't tell.
And they're spending $100, $200 for those things, and you still can't tell the difference.
Well,
maybe there is
an
audio
old
difference.
Man.
The only way I can tell the difference is if I have a mini DAC that I've got plugged in and I have $400 headphones and I'm in a pristine listening environment.
Right.
I'm sorry. Great. Okay.
No, you're right. If you're sitting in the car, there's no difference. That's right.
Right. So that's my point, but my biggest problem with the Pono, to be totally honest, other than the fact that you can't put it in a pocket, the software that it comes with is the worst piece of crap I've ever seen
in my
life.
It's Android.
No, the software on the computer to try to get
the computer software is terrible. But you don't need to use that.
It's the worst thing ever.
You don't need to use that. You plug it in on the USB and it's an SD card and you copy the music over. You don't need to use that. And I'm the idiot that bought the little Apple, the heavy metal Apple with a USB key in it that had the Beatles music at 24.
Oh, yeah.
I'm that guy. Yeah. So don't.
But that's the Beatles.
I did that too to get all the FLAC files. Yeah, that was.
Yeah, cool. I wanted the FLAC files. Well, there's a difference, isn't there, between MP3 and FLAC?
Look, there is. I mean, I would like to think I can hear the difference. Realistically, I can't. But here's my truth, and this is where I'm sort of a hypocrite on both ends. I primarily listen to music, 256 AAC compressed, whatever. But most of my CDs, most of my other stuff, I have ripped in ALAC,
Good.
Case I need to transcode it to something else. Right. And when I do rip things for easier listening, I typically use MP3 lame VO, which is typically the best compressed thing. So I drink the Kool-Aid, yet I'm also aware the Kool-Aid is, stupid.
Well, and I think that functionally, there is a market somewhere.
Tasty.
There's some people that want to have...
It's tasty.
There are some people out there that actually have the $1,000 headset and want to be able to buy those, because the headphones that they used in the David Pogue one, the problem is that those don't have the resolution that you'd be able to tell the difference.
Of course not.
That's right.
So it's like comparing two HD signals on an SD TV.
His point, a reasonable point, is that a normal person in a normal environment listening to the normal crap that they use isn't going to be able to tell the difference. But that's true. Nobody denies that.
So who's going to buy? So who would?
Well, somebody who cares about music is going to buy the best quality music. There's a legitimate argument. Is a CD as good as it needs to be? And I think that's a legitimate argument. I'm not going to get in the high res versus CD. But anybody who's listening carefully with good equipment that can not tell the difference between AAC or MP3 and FLAC.
Well,
there is a clear and obvious difference.
I think it depends on how the music's being mastered. I think the bigger problem is that a lot of times even CDs are being mastered so that they're louder.
That's the other end
of
this.
Terrible. So,
yes,
so
heavily.
If it's mastered well on a good CD, I think a good CD is going to sound every bit as good as high-res audio.
Well, that's one thing you notice, by the way, when you start listening to high-res audio is how bad. You actually have to be careful and pick good stuff. For instance, there is on HD Tracks, there's Band on the Run, Paul McCartney, and they have the version that was sold to everybody for the last 50 years or how long that stupid album's been out. And then they have an uncompressed, I'm talking about audio compression.
Right. Full range, full dynamic range.
Full dynamic range. It's a different album.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's incredible. You hear the instruments.
But even HD Tracks, some of the stuff they will sell resolutions are still not mastered well. So you'll buy an album. I did this where I bought an album and I listened to it. And I went, this still sounds like crap. If I have the vinyl version of the same album, it sounds significantly better because it's been mastered better.
That's right.
The thing is that gets me is that Neil Young's music might sound better in high resolution on massive speakers. I like Neil Young's music. I want to listen to it on Spotify when I am commuting. It pisses me off
that
he's pulled it off. I don't care if it's 3% better in high res. I want it the way I have it now.
That is one massive advantage that Apple Music has. Google Music has it as well, which is that you add your own collection to the streaming music. Mm-hmm. So if you own all of Neil Young's albums, which I hope you do, you've got it on streaming. Spotify won't do that, but Apple Music will do that. And so will Google All Access. Amazon will too, but they don't have the streaming selection.
I have a phone because I can store my music in here as well as Spotify.
Yeah.
Sonos will let you do
that. And I think a lot of artists want to try to control how people experience their art. I mean, you know, THX was just there because George didn't like the way Star Wars looked.
So we interviewed him. I highly recommend it because Neil does a very, I think, a good defense of Pono on Triangulation about a month ago. But one of the things I pointed out is, Neil, your last album, Storytone, was recorded in one of those sound booths where they do the cheap records that you buy for a buck and you take home. That was the... So he said, yeah, well, we were trying to do something. Talk about bad quality.
On purpose.
Right. But it's on purpose.
Right.
And he said, look, what I want you to hear is what I hear in the studio. I want you to hear the sound that I was making as best as possible. And I think that's a reasonable thing for an artist.
Oh, save me from purists.
Well, he's an artist. That's his art. That's what he makes.
It's rock and roll, man. But again, yes, it's art, but it's rock and roll. You listen to it where you can.
Well, I pointed that out. I said the Beatles got inspired by very crappy radio reception from pirate radio ships of American blues. But that got them excited. You can have an emotional reaction to music even if it's terrible. Terrible reproduction.
The Beatles still sounds better on mono. I mean, anybody who listens to the terrible stereo versions of the Beatles' early albums, I mean, what are you doing with your life?
Yeah, that irked me because the Green Apple that cost so much money was all stereo. It's like, why don't you do that?
Then they released a mono version. I have the digital mono set. The CDs released a mono that I then ripped. Yeah, they released a mono version a year later.
As CDs?
Yeah, I don't think they ever did it on Apple.
They never did the 24-bit version. Was never released.
No, but I got it on CDs, and then I did get the vinyl copies in mono, too.
Do you have a record player?
I do.
Wow.
So can I say something about audio quality and how it can really change the experience? Just a little experience.
Yes.
So my son's birthday was Friday, and we took him to see the San Francisco Symphony.
Oh.
They were playing, they had Star Trek, the 2009 Star Trek, and the symphony was playing the soundtrack.
Let me guess, you teared up.
Well,
it's emotional.
It's not the world's best movie, but with a full symphony blaring that music, it was amazing.
Yeah.
It was the best Star Trek I've ever seen,
and this
because
is
of the music.
This is the argument, and it's ineffable, and it's probably not provable, and there's certainly no science behind it. But that somehow there's more emotion in the full dynamic range of the music. And, of course, there's nothing better than live.
Yeah.
You want to hear it in a live environment. And I tell you what, I tear up. When I hear a great symphony playing great music, I feel it. Don't you?
Oh, yeah.
It's emotional.
Yeah. It was fantastic.
All right, let's move on. Let me do an ad read. I need to breathe for a little bit here. I wanted to ask Alex, because he's a former music director and a radio guy. So I wanted to ask him have you listened to Beats 1 at all?
I've listened to it a little bit. I thought it was fine. I mean, it was fine. It was, you know, it's something that I can listen to for a little while. It's better than the radio.
I love radio. I grew up, this is all I ever wanted to do was radio, right?
Yeah, and I loved doing that. I mean, I loved doing it. And I loved, and I do like listening to it when it's really good. I think it's better than any station that I really can think of right now in the United States that I've listened to recently.
I'll grant you that.
But that doesn't mean I still don't want to skip.
It's
and
not
as soon
a
as I
want
to skip, I go back to Spotify.
Right. That's the problem.
That's
the problem. How do you make one stream that everybody's going to like, that everybody's going to want to hear the next song and the next song and the next song? And that's hard to do now that we don't have to. It was easy when we had to. There was no choice. All you could do is push the button on the Dodge and go to the next station.
I still think we're in a very, very early stage of curation. I think that the automatic curation is not necessarily the right solution. I think that doing it all by hand is not necessarily the right solution. I think there's a lot of places in between that haven't been managed well yet.
Well, good on Apple for trying something anyway. If you are ready to get a new gadget, maybe a new iPod Touch, perhaps you would like to get rid of the old gadget, can I tell you where to go? Gazelle, the best place to sell your old, even broken iPhone, iPad, Samsung, Surface tablet. They give you top dollar. They make it easy. They give you a 30-day guarantee, so you're not even locked in. In fact, if you go right now and get the quote, get all that stuff that's stuck in a drawer somewhere, you wouldn't throw a $100 bill in a drawer and just leave it there. Well, that's what you're doing. Get it out. Go to gazelle.com, get a quote. Now, you got 30 days to do something. You don't have to buy anything yet. You can just think about it, sit on it. But get that quote, because I can tell you one thing, those devices are not gaining in value. They're going to be worth less than 30 days. So get it now. Now, once you decide, okay, I'm ready to pull the trigger, you press the button. They'll send you a box. They pay the shipping on anything worth more than a buck. That's pretty much anything, right? And then their experts will wipe the data if you forget or if it's broken and you can't. They'll also sometimes up your offer. I've had this happen twice now where they say, oh, no, that's, you know, better than you said it was. So we're going to give you. And one time, gosh, they gave us like $40 more. I was really thrilled. I never heard of it. They don't have to do that. But I've never heard of a company doing that. But they want to give you good service. They'll send you a check, a PayPal credit, or, and this is a good tip if you're an Amazon user, an Amazon gift card, which they'll bump by 5%. So you get a little extra as well. Now, you may wonder, what happens to the best stuff Gazelle gets? They sell it. They now have a certified pre-owned program. They'll sell devices in two conditions, certified like new or certified good. Like new's like new, but certified good, yeah, they're going to show a little sign of wear. But if you're replacing a broken phone or tablet, it's a great idea. For the kids, great idea. And every device that Gazelle sells has been put through its rigorous 30-point inspection. They're fully functional, and you have 30 days risk-free to return it. So this is a great way to get a new gadget or an almost new gadget. G-A-Z-E-L-L-E, gazelle.com. Just write it down, keep a note on it. And whatever you do, stop throwing the old gadgets in the drawer. That's like putting cash in the trash. Gazelle.com. Wow, Friday, did you see Google stock?
Did pretty well.
Holy camoly. Yeah.
Have a good quarter, and that's what can happen.
A very, very good quarter. Not only that, YouTube had the best quarter it's ever had. Yeah. Average YouTube viewing time is now 40 minutes,
which
doesn't sound like a lot, but as somebody who's watched ratings from TV and radio for years, that's huge.
Nobody does anything online for 40 minutes. That's the thing about
that. That's
amazing. This has got to be cumulative over a day staring at your little phone.
60% growth year over year, and they now are bigger in the most important demographic, 18 to 49, than any cable channel.
18 to 49 is like everybody.
You're looking at me when you say that?
Except us.
You know, well, it was really sad. When I went past 54, I thought, now really nobody cares. You know, nobody cares. We used to, in radio, we used to call it 55 to dead. Like, that's the demographic nobody cares about. And I would like to change that, by the way. I think that's not really appropriate. Big revenue for Google. They had...
Well, I think one of the things that makes it exciting for investors is not just that they made a lot more money, but it shows
they turn it around.
Diversify their,
yes.
They diversify their income. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mobile viewing, mobile ads, all up. There's a lot of concern about mobile ads and whether those can make it. Google certainly had dropping click cost per clicks.
Oh, boy.
Things like
which
that.
Which affects everybody in media. Everybody.
Yes.
Yeah.
That explains Gawker.
Which part?
I don't
know. Yeah, seriously. Let's not even. Oh, wow.
Is Nick Denton not the most horrible human alive today?
Oh, wait. Nick Denton, he pulled, if we're talking about the same thing I think we're talking about with the story.
He pulled the story.
He's the guy who pulled the story.
And you know why?
Because it was a terrible story.
Because it's lawsuitable. Well, it's also, you know, that you're protected. Like when he slanders me, which he does regularly, I can't sue him because I'm a public figure. Well, I can, but there's a much higher standard. Right.
Much higher statute. This is not a
I would have to show malintent on his part, like he's trying to get me. But in this case, this guy, it's a scurrilous and almost certainly untrue article, very poorly sourced. He's not a public figure.
Right.
He's an editor at a magazine. He's not a public figure.
He's not a senator.
He's not Anthony Weiner. He's just some guy. The story's almost certainly untrue. He has great standing for a lawsuit. And I think that's the reason. And by the way, it's too late, even if Nick Denton pulled it. The article came out on Thursday. He pulled it on Friday. Still was out long enough.
And the editors of Gawker are furious at him for doing that, for pulling it.
Yeah, oh, it's free speech, man.
Well, they're mad because from people I've talked to there is that it was they see it as a Chinese wall problem. So they're seeing it even if...
Well, if it is advertisers, then they're right.
Well, that's what it was from what I understand.
Advertisers should never be allowed to influence an editorial.
It was the legal team and then the advertiser and then the...
Legal's different.
Well, legal and the ad people were like, "Hey, this is bad." So
no.
I think that you know the thing from people I've talked to at Gawker is that they were upset. Even the people who disagreed that the post should have been published to begin with don't like that it was pulled for the reasons that it was pulled. The whole thing is just a mess.
I'm hoping Hulk Hogan's suing him for $100 million. I hope he wins every penny and puts the the whole blight out of business. But you know what? The internet is blighted in every respect. Every respect, it is blighted.
Except for thee and me?
Yeah, and okay. Me and thee. Yeah. Back to Google. Actually, should we stick with, you want to do Reddit? I'm sure they've talked about Reddit over the past few weeks. I'm watching on a boat, thanking God that I am not, I do not know what to say about this. On the one hand, there was reprehensible content on Reddit. On the other hand,
there still is, and
Alexis Ohanian and Steve Huffman, the new CEO who's replaced Ellen Powell, both said that Reddit is a bastion of free speech. Despite their later denials, they said it.
Mm-hmm.
And which is it? You can't have it both ways.
Well, the difference is it was a bastion of free speech before they had $50 million investment from venture capitalists. It's a bastion of free speech when you're, a very lightly staffed subsidiary of Condé Nast. It's not a bastion of free speech when you're now a subsidiary of Advanced Publications, of Advanced Media, and you have a $50 million investment from Andreessen Horowitz. And you need to actually get advertisers to buy ads on the filth that proliferates your platform. I don't know.
So Steve Huffman on Thursday did an AMA, kind of ironic, in which he posted new rules and talked about new rules for Reddit. And I have to say, I've gone through the thought exercise on my whole vacation of what would I do? And the first thing you think is, well, it's easy. You just ban hate speech. You ban...
Define hate speech.
Exactly.
It's not that easy.
No, as you were going to get to, obviously. I mean, it's really hard. I mean, there are things that
are
illegal. There are things that are damaging.
Illegal's easy. Because illegal, it's not?
Well... There are some things that are clearly over the line, but some things are not. Bullying behavior,
right?
That's open to interpretation. Yeah. It's a fuzzy line. There are things that are clearly over the line. There are things that are not. There's a big, broad middle of fuzziness.
And you can point out, as some have, that there is more white supremacist content on Reddit than there ever was on Stormfront or any of these white supremacist groups. But that's not illegal.
Until it becomes threatening.
Protected free speech is not. But the litmus test for Reddit or any other company is not whether it's legal or not.
No, I understand.
They don't have to follow
free speech
that.
Only applies to government. And
no one says that
Reddit or Steve Huffman can't say right now, we're just going to arbitrarily kill anything we don't like. He can, of course, do that. But he does it at his peril because, and this is the problem Twitter has and Facebook has and everybody has, the content is not created by Reddit. The content is created by... us.
Reddit is community content, but it's run by individuals at a company. So,
moderators are not individuals at a company. There are the public as well.
And that's, but at some point, Reddit has its keys. The people at Reddit have their fingers on the buttons.
Yeah.
So is that the question is that the right model for Reddit? Or has Reddit outgrown the standard model of, here, we're going to run a website, and give moderation capabilities to these various people. Is it time for that model to change to where the business people or the people running the site step away and it becomes more of a different kind of public trust where people can vote up or vote down whether something should be banned?
That's the point that many of the Redditors make, which is, A, you should be allowed to put stuff that we disagree with up on Reddit, and we will use the up and down vote to make sure that we respond.
Which, again,
and isn't that the best way to do it?
Is a utopian fantasy that will actually work because it's easy enough for somebody to have a campaign and game that system where really horrible stuff could be pushed through by a lot of upvotes, and the downvotes wouldn't have a chance in hell.
Well, and what typically happens more often than not is that you see some people gaming the system to push the downvotes, to push good content down. You know, that's where trolls usually exist more, at least from our experience from doing a lot of things that are similar to what Reddit does, is that there's a big reason why there's no down arrow in Facebook, and there's no down arrow in Google+, and there's no down arrow because that's where things tend to be gamed. And so I think that as soon as you decide you want to turn it into a business, you generally have to, like the streets of San Francisco, you have to start cleaning up the streets before people are going to put businesses there. And I think that they had it all as a free-for-all, and then they decided they wanted to make money with it, and they might have to decide between the two, like how much investment can be made. And it's really tricky to do it in the middle. You know, that's the hardest part of a social network is you create a bunch of rules, and now you changing the rules in the middle. Are you going to gain enough people, you know, coming in because it's cleaned up to afford to lose what could be? I mean, they may have to decide we're going to get rid of 30, 40, 50% of our, you know, community so that we can, you know, excise that out. And even people who weren't necessarily outrageous, but don't believe in cutting off that speech. You know, are they willing to cut 40-50% of their community to gain possibly more? And I think that remains to be seen.
Well, okay, you guys, stop hedging your bets here. What should Reddit do?
I'd say clean it up.
Clean up. So I mean, is Steve Huffman doing the right thing? Is he not doing enough? Should he do more?
I don't think he's doing enough.
I don't think he's doing enough. I think that you need to get rid of the white supremacists. You need to get. I mean, we're just not. You know, we're done with that. You know, like he has to get that off.
It's like our raping woman is account. It's gone as it should be. But C-Town is allowed to stay. Like honestly, you can't draw the line that arbitrarily. If you're going to clean it up, clean it up. If you're not, don't. So to me, you've either got to defend it all the way, or you've got to actually take real action to get rid of the filth.
So he's not gone far enough.
I don't think so.
Well, he's got to go. I think the problem right now is he's straddling the fence, you know, and he needs to. They either need to let go and continue down that path, or they need to completely go, and they have to do it quickly, so that you know they can start making that rather than this whole back and forth. It just leaves everybody upset for a long time.
I don't envy them. I mean, I know Alexis and Steve both have been on Triangulation. I have a lot of respect for both of them.
No, I mean, and honestly, a lot of this stuff isn't their fault. I mean, you know, Steve is coming back in after being away for years. Alexis was away for a long time and came back. A lot of this kind of, you know, the community grew. I would criticize them. I would say, you know, when they started to see this was becoming a problem back during the Violent Acres period, so back when you had, you know, the creep shots and the, you know, jailbait and that kind of era, that was when I think that the people had read it, and I don't know if Steve and Alexis were still really heavily involved then or not. I don't think they were.
No, I don't think they were either.
They should have stepped in, and they should have said, okay, this is now where it's starting to cross the line, and we need to start moving the community away from this sort of thing. I think that it didn't. And so Reddit, you know, became even more known for having kind of, you know, the reputation where anything goes and kind of celebrated that and grew in large part because of that. I think the problem with that is that obviously now it's gotten to the point where it's so big, they're not making money off of it despite its bigness. They're trying to make money off of it and realizing, oh, actually, this is now a really kind of terrible place in a lot of respects. And a lot of really great things happen here, but a lot of really terrible things happen here too.
Is it okay to use Reddit and ignore the bad stuff that's going on and just say, well, I'm only going to go to the subreddits that are good? Is that okay?
It depends. I mean, I think you can.
I'm asking your permission.
Problem is, I mean,
some have said there is a moral, you have a moral imperative not to use Reddit at all because any use of Reddit supports C-Town and these other things.
No.
I don't know if I'd go that far. I mean, you could say the same thing about Usenet or any other kind of, you know, big network forum things that are of that regard. I wouldn't go that far. I mean, if someone wanted to boycott the whole thing because of some of the objectionable stuff, obviously that's their right. But I don't think that it means that just because you like certain subreddits that have nothing to do with the other stuff and you have your own community ecosystem, that you should somehow feel guilty because other parts of this kind of weird, you know, octopus of networks has nasty stuff in it. I think the bigger problem is that because they didn't step in 4 years ago, a lot of the stuff that's happening now is happening. And I don't know if I almost feel like it's too late. It's like, I don't know what Steve can do. I don't think he's doing enough. I don't know what more he can do other than starting with baby steps, because I do fear for their sake. You know, we've seen how quick communities can just disappear, and even humongous sites can just die in nanoseconds. And I think that's probably going to happen to Reddit, because what it once was is not going to be what it is again. And that doesn't mean that what it could be couldn't be great, but they're kind of in this period of, you know, change and lots of things happening that the one advantage they have, the only reason I think that people haven't jumped ship already the way that people did from Digg, is that Digg had Reddit to support the overflow of people. What is there to replace Reddit? There isn't anything. So until there's a replacement for Reddit, they're okay. But little by little, you know, the people who you know, for right or for good or for ill, kind of keep the community running and keep things happening and the wheels turning are going to disappear, and that's a problem.
Boy, you know, what's so funny about this is that I don't see any of this stuff on. I'm not a super huge user of Reddit, but I do read it. I get a lot of information from there, and all the horrible stuff that's on Reddit, I never see. Yeah. I've never seen it. I'm not deep enough into it. And
there's no way to see it unless you actively seek it.
And if Reddit has to die because of hateful, whatever it is, crap that most people probably never ever see, that's just a tragedy. I mean.
But I don't think that. I think that if we decide that 90% of the traffic is really not that, I think that they don't have a lot to risk. I think they have a lot of really angry folks that are 10 or 15% of the market. It might be more than that. It could be 25, 30%. But I think people like us, like I'm in the same boat. I see Reddit when I do a search for something and there's a discussion that pops up. I mean, I don't really go
to it. Is there a place on the internet for somewhere that anything goes?
What?
8chan.
Yeah. Actually, I guess Usenet is that, the news groups. Yeah. There's no, because there is no central commercial entity involved.
The thing about Reddit that makes it such a lightning rod for this is that it's so easy to get this horrible stuff that is totally out there and available. It's just easier on Reddit.
Nowhere to look, yeah. Well, and it happened, it started with the Fappening, but I think the mainstream got aware of this was, oh, you want those nude pictures? Oh, you go to Reddit.
Go to Reddit. And the thing is that because the front page of Reddit is driven not just by things you follow, but also by other things from the community, oftentimes the front page, you'll end up seeing stuff that maybe you didn't want to see. So, for instance, I mean, and that's where the corrosive aspects of the community do tend to fall into other subreddits. So if you're a new Reddit user and you sign up, you know, you're automatically subscribed to a few big subreddits. And if, you know, our images has really gross content, or if some of these other popular R news or things are happening, big controversy, you can be made aware of some of the bigger stuff that's happening in the community, whether you want to or not. I also think that the you know, while although many parts of Reddit are very nice, part of the tenor of the conversation, because it has kind of been known as this place where anything can happen, is corrosive. I was talking with a friend of mine, a guy I work with, and he wanted to look back and see his very first Reddit comment. And so he logged in to see something from like 2010. And the first response to him was calling him a guy and saying something terrible to him. And so he kind of realized, oh, from the very beginning, something that I said that it was completely innocuous, it was really this terrible. So there's certainly, I think that there's an element where you're allowed to act a certain way on Reddit, and it's acceptable in a lot of the communities, whereas it wouldn't be acceptable in a lot of other online spaces.
Yeah. There are, of course, Reddit alternatives out there. There's one called Vote, V-O-A-T, which is, I think a lot of people are fleeing to saying, well, we want unlimited free speech.
Yeah, that's where a lot of the fat people hate and the other kind of terrible, terrible people have gone.
I'm really torn. I don't think it's easy at all. I think, I don't know. I feel like I can see both sides of the case. Let's put it that way. We don't allow free speech in our chat room, obviously. We have moderators. We have rules, and we're very clear about those rules. We've never said, though, that the chat room was a bastion of free speech.
It's your party.
Right. Well, that's the problem.
But at the same time, I understand it's community-driven, and I want it to be community-run, so we let the community run it. I don't run it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of a compromise, I guess.
Right, but you don't have 50 billion people in your chat room.
That's what happens,
it's manageable.
Right? If it's a small number, every website, every internet gathering spot, every community is great. Mm-hmm. And then there's some number that it flips. The well was Usenet.
It's a mixture of things. I mean, I think that it's one of the reasons that, you know, Facebook adheres to or tries to push things like your real name. I know when we had a fledgling social network that we were building, we required a photo that looked like you.
I kind of want to do that. I kind of want to. You have to show a newspaper and a picture of yourself.
Well, we had it basically when you registered. Ours was a paid social network. It's, you know, and
use a credit card. Yeah.
Yeah, well, we knew who you were, and you needed to use your name, and and we actually have instructions on how to build your profile picture, and so, but it was really it was amazing how just that one simple action cleaned up all the conversation, because you know you really everyone knew who you were, and that takes a lot of that a lot of the stuff out that bothers us. And then, of course, everyone reported everyone else. And you also just created a culture. We created a culture that was very much like, that's not going to be appropriate.
But isn't there a point? There's two points. There's a point to be made that really free speech is good because it challenges your preconceived notions. And it and if it's a terrible idea, if it's racism, if it's fat hate, then you should know it exists and you should fight it with all your might. And if it weren't for free speech, you might not. You know, I think there's an argument that open and free is a good thing, but there's also the argument that anonymity is a good thing. Now, I agree with you. In fact, we talked about this when I did the Nerdist. Chris Hardwick said, you know, if people had to identify themselves, there'd be no problem. Because people most of the time will not say horrendous things if you know who they are. That's your position, I guess, Alex. Well, but there's also a case where you need to be anonymous. There's reasons. Right. I
mean, there is. And Chris, Chris Poole has argued that from 4chan for a long time. Yeah. And to good effect. But, you know, where you draw the line is the hard part. Because, like I said, everybody can agree on certain cases. But one of the things that's coming up right now in academia is this whole issue of things that offend or trigger people. The whole trigger warning issue.
Yeah.
And at some point, at a lot of points, people just fundamentally disagree on what is acceptable and what is not acceptable. And both people could be completely reasonable, well-meaning people who completely disagree on something being, well, that's fine, people should be exposed to it, it's the world, or that is completely, utterly unacceptable and must not be allowed to be seen by anybody. And
that's kind of not right. That's not what we want, right?
Well, it's not what we want.
I understand in the university, but I feel,
and I think that there's definitely, when you have a business and a community that you're trying to build with a certain flavor to it, I think that, you know, having a lot of control makes a lot of sense. I think that in a lot of rules of engagements of how community
and we
going
do.
To work.
I mean, we're the example of that. We heavily control it.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I think that, but I think, I don't believe the government should make it illegal. And I don't think there are plenty of places. But I think Reddit's making a business, needs to make a business decision. And that's, you know, they're not making a political decision about whether free speech should ever exist. But I think they need to make a business decision about whether they want that kind of free speech on their site where they're trying to sell ads next to it. I mean, we have
the Is there a future for Reddit? Are they done?
I don't see they should. Done. Why should they be done?
It's not a dig thing where it's like going to be just like,
I think they've been around a lot longer. They have a lot more.
Actually, they haven't. They're the same age as Dig.
Yeah, I think that there's not a replacement for anybody to just go to. I mean, I think that if there was already an entrenched community where people could go, then it would be a lot easier to say that they're done. I think because there's not, I don't think that they're done. That said, I think that, you know, they have a very limited time period to kind of work this stuff out.
Yeah, I think it's public opinion issue about whether they're in control, and for their advertisers, for their investors, I think it's mostly you know, feeling like they push it out.
I mean, we have to figure out what
they could afford to lose half of their traffic and still make money.
Yeah, they have 140 million uniques a month.
We have to figure out what Reddit is. I mean, is it a common carrier? Is it a university? Is it somebody's private party?
Right.
And tell me what Reddit is, and that discussion becomes much easier.
I don't want to live in a world where there isn't somewhere where anybody can say anything. I think that's important. I know this sounds weird, but I think there is a good argument to be made that I don't think people should be allowed to encourage violence against other people.
Well, you just undid what you just said then.
Well, and I think that the reason that we have the
the First Amendment. Mm-hmm. In fact, says, you know, as long as you don't incite to violence or, you know, then anything goes. That's the First Amendment.
That's really, yes, it's really vague.
Yeah. And there have, of course, been many Supreme Court cases and others defining it a little bit. But I don't think that that's a bad standard. The reason I say that is there's horrible things people can say.
So we need a Supreme Court.
But they need to be able to say that. And I think it's valuable that it's said and it's exposed. Otherwise, it goes underground.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also it builds up pressure when people don't feel like they're heard, when they don't feel like they can say anything. You know, that those are the people who oftentimes become violent. And so there's a good reason to have, you know, outlets for people to say it rather than do it. So I think that it is important. I definitely think there should be places on the Internet that allow that. It's just the question is whether Reddit is that place.
Yeah. And I should be clear. The First Amendment is not as ambiguous. It says the government shall not abridge free speech, but subsequent court cases have narrowed it to say, you know, there are some limits on that. You can't shout fire in a crowded theater. You can't incite to violence, things like that. I think it's a good conversation. I wanted to have this. I know it's a little bit old news, although Steve Huffman's rules just came out, so maybe there's some timeliness to it. But I was sitting here watching this as I'm floating down the river, and there's nothing else to do, and I'm thinking, boy, I want to talk about this.
Good week to be on a river.
Yeah, except for the 95-degree heat wave in Europe, yes. Let's take a break. Come back. Google is challenging Apple for beacons. It's kind of interesting. They've also hired some folks from HomeJoy. We'll talk about what HomeJoy is all about, but I'll let your imagination think about it for a little bit until we do. $60 billion to the stock in one day on Friday. $65 billion in stock worth.
And what's the percentage raise on that?
8%. Yeah. Yeah.
It gives you
some idea. That's amazing. I would like to talk about Windows, Microsoft. You know, we're just 11 days off, 10 days off from Windows 10.
Mm-hmm.
Satya Nadella giving Mary Jo Foley an excellent interview. Could talk about that. Taking a $7 billion+ write-off on Windows Phone as well. Lots more to talk about. But meanwhile, let's take a break and see. I actually want to see this. What happened when I was gone this week on Twit?
Go for it.
Previously on Twit, Windows Weekly.
Mary Jo Foley got some sit-down time with Satya.
What was very interesting about this interview, they said you can talk to him about anything you want. You've got 30 minutes.
One thing that I thought was complete, the notion that he decided to make Windows 10 free to help Windows Phone is absurd.
The new screensavers.
This is the makey-makey. You use things in everyday life to make a circuit.
That's cool.
The purpose of it is to take any everyday object, whether it's a bobblehead, a banana, your grandma, or a plant or a flower, and control any part of your computer using any software, and it should take no more than a minute, even if you have no experience.
Know-how.
This is a great opportunity to do a little science fair stuff.
If we want to test whether or not this phone soap is going to be able to get rid of the bacteria on this phone.
Oh, are you going to swab it?
We're doing a bacterial test.
Ew.
Take the heat down because it's going to boil over.
Good thing nothing ever goes wrong on this set.
This is your brain. This is your brain on Twit. Any questions?
They asked me if they could test the bacterial content of my keyboard. I said no. I don't want to know. Just best left unknown. What's coming up on the week ahead? Mike Elgin has it. The story.
Coming up this week, IBM reports earnings tomorrow, July 20th. Also tomorrow, PayPal and eBay will officially become two separate companies. Then on Tuesday, Apple, Microsoft, Yahoo, and Verizon will announce their earnings. Tuesday is also the day when Google Plus Photos app for Chrome will no longer work. Photos won't be deleted, but can be found in Google Photos. Qualcomm reports earnings on Wednesday. Also on Wednesday, Xiaomi is expected to unveil a new Steel smartphone. Huawei is probably going to announce their new Honor X smartphone Wednesday as well. And then on Thursday, Pandora and Amazon will have their earnings calls, and Best Buy is holding a sale on Friday and Saturday called Black Friday in July. That's what's coming up this week. Back to you, Leo.
Did you guys buy anything on Prime Day on Wednesday?
Missed it.
It was all crap.
Headphones. I got some headphones.
For how much did you save?
Did you get any Beats, did you?
$80? No. I got some Bose headphones. That
that's a lot.
$150. And they were $150. I got them for $70.
Oh, okay.
I think that Wednesday was actually one of the few days that I didn't buy something.
It's amateur day. You don't want to be there when the amateurs.
I was like, I don't know. I don't know how I missed that.
You know, I don't know. Mike didn't mention, but it's not this week. It's a week coming up. And I'm wondering if you're going to go, Christina, that Motorola is having an event in New York on July 28th.
Oh, yeah. No, if I don't go, then someone else from the team will.
I hope you go, because I have always had a soft spot in my heart, and maybe my head, for the Moto X. I love the first generation, a little less on the second generation, and I presume...
I don't love the second generation, but I like the Moto X. I love the Moto G, I have to say. That's one of my favorites.
And I presume they're going to announce something new along those lines, right? And maybe a new Moto X. The invitation did have... It looked like XOX... But actually, if you look at it carefully, it's XGX.
That looks like a 6 to 8.
Oh, that's cool.
So that implies maybe there's a new G and two new Xs. I don't know. That's what some said.
It's a really bad game of tic-tac-toe.
Okay, well, let us know, Christina, because I'm curious. Of course, we got rumors that there's a new Galaxy S6 Plus Edge over, what is it, something new Motorola's going to announce. The OnePlus 2's coming out.
OnePlus 2.
And even a rumor that the Note 5, which normally Samsung announces in the fall at IFA, will be announced this month as well. So will be a lot of stuff going on. Our show today brought to you, I should have said that all before the Gazelle ad, actually. Get your quotes now, because there's new phones coming. Our show today brought to you by FreshBooks, which is such a lifesaver for anybody who's doing invoicing, small businesses or freelancers. I was one of them. I discovered FreshBooks 10 years ago, and it saved my life because I was never doing the invoices. I was putting it off. FreshBooks makes it easy not only to send an invoice, but you'll get paid faster because it makes it easy for your clients to pay you using online payment services of their choice. And that's really nice. You can use FreshBooks to create and send invoices. You can also use the FreshBooks app to capture and manage expenses. You can even take pictures of receipts. And time and hours couldn't be easier. You use the app, keep track of it, assign it to a client, and all of that then gets sucked right up into the invoice. And at the end of every month, you've got it done. It's so nice. Easy to use. In fact, they've done some research. Most FreshBooks users save around 16 hours a month on admin tasks. It's like two full work days a month. And they get paid an average of 5 days faster. I think you're going to like that. I can absolutely verify that. Of course, I was getting paid faster because I never invoiced. So even that as a start, just invoicing every month made a huge difference for me. And if you ever need support, the FreshBooks support rock stars are ready by the phones. They will amaze you with their helpfulness. Really great people up there in Toronto. I am a fan. I used them for a long time. And your accountant will love it come tax time, too. Easy to get started. Free for 30 days. There's no obligation. Go to FreshBooks.com/twit. Just do me one favor. When they ask you how'd you hear about us, say twit. FreshBooks.com/twit, a 30-day free trial awaits. And, you know, I think you're going to tell me it makes a big difference. FreshBooks.com/twit. We're talking about Apple, and they announced, it was like a year ago, iBeacon. Using Bluetooth LE, the idea was that your iPhone could announce its presence. You'd be in a store, and it would either trigger a display in the store, or maybe you'd get a coupon on the iPhone. This kind of lightweight location system. I remember, Alex, when we started talking about it on Mac Break, people were very bullish about this. Nothing has happened.
Well, I think that it depends on the team. It depends on what they're doing. But I think this is a good example of the difference between like iBooks and iBeacon and Apple Pay. Is Apple Pay, they got it out into a lot of places very, very quickly, and it actually seems to have some traction. Whereas with these, they, you know, that heavy control that Apple has may be slowing, you know, a lot of the development down without investing heavily in, you know, rolling it out themselves. I think they expect everyone just to go run with it, but they didn't. But it's too controlling for everyone to just go run with it. If they had put a lot of investment into that at the same time, they might have been more successful. I do think that the Google approach to this may succeed much more quickly.
This is called Eddystone, and it's open, which is great. So one problem with iBeacon, of course, it only works on Apple devices.
It works on Android too. You can get different implementations.
Oh, you can.
You can. The problem with, I mean, beacon technology, obviously Apple has the patent or, you know, the trademark on iBeacon, but the beacons themselves do work on Android.
The problem is
that you know, oftentimes the Bluetooth stack, frankly, on Android has been bad for so long.
Right.
It's not widely supported, but you will find retailers, for instance, who will put iBeacon-compatible beacons that also work with Android, you know, in their locations and whatnot.
Okay. So do you think Eddystone is significant, or is it?
It's different from iBeacon. iBeacon sends out codes only that the receiving device has to know what to do with. Eddystone will also send out URLs or even other what they call frame types or different types of data. So it's a way for a small device, a very small, low-power device, to broadcast in a very short range to other devices the location and a small bit of data to make technology really location aware. It's pretty important stuff.
Maybe one of the reasons iBeacon was DOA 2 years ago is because it collided with a sudden awareness of privacy issues.
Right.
That people suddenly, I don't want my phone telling a retailer I'm here. That's not exactly not what I want to have happen.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, and that's sort of the challenge. I mean, I think that definitely this stuff is important. I think that the challenge it'll face, the same one that iBeacon has, is how do you get, you know, lots and lots of people to buy these devices and implement them and implement the apps that will support them. You know, certain retailers have gone really, have been really bullish on beacons, and certainly you've seen implementations in ballparks and other places. But even if this technology is better, and even if it's really interesting, I mean, you've still got to convince people, especially, you know, places that might have already invested in beacons, to buy these things and actually implement them and then build software for them. And I think that that's, those are, you know, hurdles that are not easy to get over, no matter how good your technology might be.
My suspicion is Eddie Stone is as DOA as iBeacon was, not because of the technology not being as good or whatever, just because nobody wants that. Retailers might want it, but I don't think customers want it.
Well, when you go into an Apple store right now, you see iBeacon. If you have an iOS,
what happens?
It says, welcome to the Apple store. Reminder, you can use your phone to buy stuff.
Oh, great. Thank you, Apple.
It's actually not,
I don't want that.
If you're going in to buy something, it's not the end of the world.
No, it's actually kind of interesting.
I would love to see it.
What, how does it help me? I mean, I'm here. I'm in the store. Yes, I'm buying something.
It can show you where something is. And, I mean, like at the ballpark, for instance, you can use it to kind of locate, like, this is where, you know, the concessions are, or this is where this beer vendor is, or this is something else.
Okay, so a big spot that might be kind of useful.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you can imagine kind of in a big shopping mall, a big complex, even a flea market, like here in New York, you know, in Brooklyn, we have this thing, the Brooklyn Flea. It would actually be kind of cool if they
had. So what happens?
You know,
can you query it? How do you... So I'm here. I got to the flea market. It says, welcome to the Boston flea market. Now
right.
What?
I mean, if you assume, presumably you have an app installed, you can then open up the app. You could get other information kind of sent to you. Here's a coupon code.
Does it launch a nav thing? Does it say turn left at the Shawls?
I mean, it could conceivably, depending on the implementation you want to use. That's kind of the problem. You've got to build all this stuff.
Nobody's doing
right
any
now.
Of that.
Right.
And I think that is actually the navigation is one of the places that it could go really, really well, where there's a lot of places that you get very limited once you get there. You know, mm-hmm. So the GPS can get you to the convention hall, but it can't tell you what room to go into or how to get to that room. And exactly. I think that iBeacon has or all of these low energy Bluetooth have the opportunity to provide that. And not only can it tell us what booth, where to find our booths, or build a path that we can follow to find these booths and tell us whether we're on the right track, but it can also help us find other people that we're trying to find. You know, so I find, you know, there's a lot of like, where are you in the Las Vegas Convention Center, for instance? You know, the North
right.
Hall or the Central Hall is a big word. You know, that's still an hour of wandering around trying to figure out which booth is 4465. You know, and so so being able to tell everyone, meet me here, and being able to, on an app, do that, I think you'd find a lot of people using it. Families in malls, or in Disneyland, in all these other things. Being able to precisely identify where they are, they could end up using it a lot beyond all the commercial things. Now, and I think that what retailers have to do, and what people trying to commercialize, is they have to look at that first. How do I get something that people want to use all the time? And then we'll figure out how to make money with it. But we have to get them actually excited about opening the app and knowing where they are and getting something that is of real value before we try to sell them something.
One of the things to watch out for in all these things is that beacon technology, no matter whose, is a way to get information from a device onto a phone automatically, which means...
It's a risk.
There is a risk factor involved, and it's one of the things that we're looking at right now. Because our hacker, the Make hackers, are using
beacons?
Well, we're looking at it. It's really cool. You can do cool things with it.
I think that
Google's also well positioned because they have Google Now. So Google Now could respond to a beacon, and already it's kind
really
of set up to, and I'm using Now, and it just kind of makes sense to me that I'm going to get a card about this that might be of use, or a coupon. I just feel like people don't. Are so sensitive now to this, to the risks.
Yeah, I mean,
I don't think the average person is.
I don't know it exists.
I think it depends.
I'm telling my daddy has to put a code on his phone.
Yeah.
What
it does show, though, very clearly, is the difference between Apple and Google. Google doesn't make money on these kinds of technologies, so they can make it open source. It's on GitHub. They can let anybody do it. I'm sure your makers would be much more likely to implement Eddie Stone than iBeacon, just because it's open. But Apple needs to make money on its products. I mean, that's how Apple makes money.
Apple makes enough money on its hardware.
But they do stuff that's going to support the hardware and sell hardware in the long run. Google's just going to do stuff that makes you use the internet more because then they can, you know, I don't know what, spy. I don't know what Google's. What is Google's business? I don't know.
advertising.
Used to be advertising. Ad. Is it?
Yeah.
Still is.
And look at their earnings.
That's oh, yeah. They're doing all right. This hacking team story is interesting. I haven't exactly been following the hacking team. Does anybody want to fill me in on what's going on here? Hacking Team was a security researching firm that was apparently selling zero-day exploits.
Right.
And then got hacked.
Yep.
And the zero-day exploits got released. And, man, there's a flash exploit. There's OpenSSL problems. Steve talked about it, I know, on Security Now a lot. Maybe we should just leave the discussion for the pros.
Probably. Can I just say, though, that when I was covering products back at CNET, the most uncomfortable conversations I ever had were the ones with the antivirus guys when they come in to pitch. Ugh. It's like, aren't you like selling the viruses out the other side, the other door? I mean,
you didn't accuse them of that, did you?
No, of course not. I'd be, you know, I wouldn't.
I think a lot of people think I'm just naturally cynical. Yeah, but I don't think they're doing it. They don't need to do that. There's plenty of people making viruses. They don't need to sell some more. Or do they?
Well, I mean, you know, try to convince, you know, especially in the era when you've got stuff built in by, you know, Microsoft and Apple and all these other companies started to have kind of built-in antivirus and anti-malware things. You know, why should an enterprise or why should a consumer still buy your product?
Mm-hmm.
Good point.
All the antivirus guys are going to kill me now for saying that, but
I don't think I like these guys. by the way, they're pretty much out of business, right? I mean, Microsoft is now building a virus antivirus into Windows. Windows 10 will have it as well.
Wait for the first great Mac virus.
Yeah, right. You know, there's but Apple has done, I think, very good things and less obvious things. They don't build in an antivirus, but they have some really smart technology that allows them to spot malware and to remove it without your knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like Apple is probably being fairly proactive on this.
Right, and they control their stores.
And they control it.
Right, I mean, that's the big thing is that by default, you know, the gatekeeper thing is turned on, so mm-hmm. you can't install software that isn't signed. And most of the time it's the unsigned stuff is where the Mac viruses, the Mac Trojans come from. So if right. you've downloaded, you know, you pirated something and it's unsigned, you know, you've got to actually actively right-click and click open, or you've got to actively change right. your yeah. settings to run that file. If it's been signed by a developer, in theory, of course, there are people can still kind of there's always a way around things, but you know, if something's been signed by a developer, then it's the likelihood of it having any sort of malware on it is very, very limited.
Flash, that was one of the bugs that the hacking
yeah.
team had.
Mm-hmm.
I thought for sure, and maybe I misread it, but when I was away, that Flash was over.
Have you been on any corporate intranets lately?
Yeah, no, it's not.
Flash lives in the one place where you really don't want Flash to survive, in all these old intranet. Internal company sites that have been hacked together by people years ago and they still run Flash.
But, well, and to be honest, if you're watching this show on our website, you're probably watching it in Flash as well. But
those technologies aren't there. You know, the technologies, especially to replace
streaming
video on the web is yeah. not. And I've had some recent experiences with trying to use things other than Flash, and it's a little frightening, you know. And so you do want that to go, and that technology is moving down that path, but it's, you know, not there yet in some areas. And I think, but I do think that people do need, as you know, has been suggested by some technologists, a dead date. You know, that we're going to
Facebook,
get rid of Flash.
Sunset. In fact, is saying let's dump Flash. Facebook's security chief says it's time to say, you know, we're going to, on this date, get rid of Flash, and that'll be it. Alex Stamos tweeted, it's time for Adobe to announce the end of the life date for Flash and to ask browsers to set kilobits on the same day. Firefox maybe jumped the gun because the latest version of Firefox blocks Flash.
And right, well, that's because of the zero-day hole.
Because of the hacking team hole.
Yes.
But and we'll presumably unblock it at some point.
They'll unblock it as soon as, you know, Adobe gets the thing fixed. But, yeah, I mean, Firefox has a reputation. They have a kind of a duty to their customers to not let something through that could potentially harm them. And if we know that there's this big zero-day exploit that has been hacked by the hackers and is now all over the place, and that a million people could start, you know, to build tools to take advantage of that exploit, yeah, I mean, I think that maybe they're more proactive than maybe they had to be. I don't know, but I don't blame them for taking the method and saying, yeah, we're not going to support this until you patch your stuff.
And the question is, do we have to wait for Adobe to do this, or does Apple, Google, Firefox, or Mozilla and
that's probably what's going to happen, right?
All just say, hey, we're going to all do this on this day.
You know, right. Because Adobe's not going to say, oh, we're going to kill it on this day. Why would they do that?
No. I think they kind of would, because they would. I think in a perfect world, Adobe's ready to get rid of Flash. You know, they're trying to migrate people away from it. They're trying to migrate people into other types of tools. They've shifted their business away from Flash. You know, they went from being so anti, even bringing up a couple, you know, 5 years ago, if I would bring up with Adobe, you know, why can't you guys just embrace HTML5? I would talk to one guy at Adobe who was like, I'm with you. I agree. This sucks, but I'm like the only person here who's saying this. And, you know, 5 years later, you know, they don't support it on mobile. I think they would like to move people into their HTML5 solutions. They would. They have, you know, a suite of streaming video solutions and servers that can run on different platforms that they would like to sell. They have different tools for software creators and web developers and technologies they would like to use and sell. They don't want to continue supporting, you know, Flash and Director stuff forever.
Well, we'll see what happens. You know, it would be a problem for us because we don't stream our own content. We use Ustream. Ustream has had non-Flash streaming, but they also have Flash streaming. We also use Bitgravity, which is Flash only, as I think. We do pay for an HLS, an HTTP streamer, because of our people who use iOS can't obviously use Flash. The fact that you could use an iPhone and iPad and never use Flash, and you could successfully navigate the modern world, kind of indicates it's not necessary.
Time. Not for video, anyway.
Yeah. But it would require our providers to adjust, and I presume they would. It wouldn't. It's not up to us. It would.
And they're all working on it. I mean, they're all. Everyone knows that it's coming.
What's
eventually.
VP9? What is this? What is the replacement?
I mean, there's a lot of possibilities. Dash is one of the things that people are looking at as
Is Dash a codec? What is Dash?
Dash is just another
codec.
Flash is a wrapper. Usually, it's around H.264 MPEG-4.
Right. Right.
There's a video in HTML5. There's a video tag bracket video bracket, and to my knowledge, still has not been defined what's supposed to happen in a browser when it sees that tag.
Well, there's been conflict. I mean, Mozilla primarily hasn't wanted to support H.264 because of the patent encumbrance stuff with it. So they would prefer to support, AUG and VP8 and WebM. WebM obviously hasn't taken off. I mean, Google doesn't even use it. But Mozilla has started to at least start to move a little bit on H.264, especially on systems where it comes already part of the operating system and even on their mobile stuff. So, yeah, I mean, the codec, the specification of the video tag is basically it'll play whatever video is there, and then it's up to your browser or your hardware whether or not it can play back the codec or not. So it just has, video tag going to the file, and then it's up to your system whether or not it can play the file. But it could conceivably play it in any format. The spec itself for video doesn't care.
So, Alex, is Dash unencumbered? Or are there patent issues with Dash as well?
Dash is just the wrapper. So what you end up with is a situation where, kind of what was just being discussed, is that you have... There's a couple different things that happen. So I get a video, and then I stream that video out to a CDN, and that can be whatever format it is. I mean, that can be H.264, it can be a lot of other things, but that's sent to them, and then it has to be split up. And so when you're watching something online, that's all being cut up into a whole bunch of little adaptive bit rates. So we're going to give you 4 to 9 bit rates, and we're going to decide, oh, you're on a phone, this is what you're going to get. Now that. How that is being stacked up and managed in this kind of a simplified version of this, but how that's all being stacked up depends on these different protocols and how Flash is doing it, or Dash, or or HLS. And so how these things get done, it's not necessarily changing how it's being compressed, but it is changing how it's being managed. And then you have a player on the other side that's then making decisions about how it's getting that data. But it does make a big difference on how it's being requested. So for instance, there is a way that all of these CDNs, basically what they're doing is they're peering. So I get, I have what's called an origin server, and I'm getting that. I send that to that server, and it sends it out to peers, and then they send it out to peers, and they send it out to peers. So that out on the edge, you're not getting slammed with You know, you're not getting slammed. It's just those locations that are getting that. It's theoretically local to them. It's not putting a lot of pressure on a single server. But how chatty those protocols are, you know, is very can vary. So, you know, one of the things we found so far is that the protocol that, you know, Dash is different than Flash, and it's the way it's making requests based on things that are going on can put a lot more pressure on the
servers.
What is
does YouTube use Dash? What does YouTube do?
No, YouTube is still using. Actually, I don't know.
Are they VP9?
They're using a lot of different things. They're still using VP, you know, VP8, I believe, is in part of it. You know, they're using, you know, there's a variety of, you know, HTML5.
Because they don't support Flash, right?
No, they do, but they've switched it still has a Flash fallback, but they did finally switch to HTML5 as the default. And I think that they primarily use H.264. They do have VP8 and you know, WebM, but I think they primarily use H.264. Just because, you know, so many mobile devices use that instead. But they did, I can't remember when, it's been within the last year, they made HTML5 the actual default. And then there was the Flash fallback, so if you're on a really old system that doesn't support it, there will be, you know, Flash support. For
part of this reason this is confusing is because there's wrappers, which are things like Flash or MKV or QuickTime movies. There's codecs, which are inside the wrappers, and those two don't necessarily indicate which you're going to be.
Right.
And so it's all very confusing. YouTube currently uses, I'm just looking here on their engineering blog, VP9 for the high def and 4K video that they stream. This is the codec. I think that they want to become the default codec on the internet. They kind of admitted that VP8 is still encumbered. It is not a completely open technology. I think they hope that VP9 will be.
And VP9 is very impressive. You know, I mean, the quality of VP9 is very, very impressive.
And like any good solution for the future, it's bandwidth adaptive. So if you have low bandwidth, you could still get a stream and get something that's okay. But if you have enough bandwidth, you can get 4K as well. So Chrome uses VP9. Android devices support it. Some game consoles support it. And I would guess this is kind of the future. But, boy, you just don't know. This is an interesting image they have on the engineering blog where you compare. And I don't know. Those of you who are watching on H.264 may not notice this. But if you look at VP9, same stream, same bit rate, that's a 600 kilobit connection, there's a huge difference in the clarity between H.264, which is really kind of blocky and artifacted, and VP9.
And then there's also H.265, which, you know, is similar to VP9.
Is that HVEC? So confusing.
Yeah. I mean, the biggest problem, I think, honestly, with a lot of the codec stuff is getting the hardware support. So, like, even though Chrome and Android might support VP9, does it have hardware encoded transcoding support for it?
So nobody questions battery life. We've got to replace Flash, but you see why we haven't.
It's just a wrapper. I mean, it's just a really nice wrapper. I think that you could conceivably come up with a different type of wrapper that would not have as many security holes. I mean, you could even call it Flash. It would just be, you know, not be reliant on all the stuff that, you know, Macromedia started 20 years ago.
Well, if you're running a computer and you don't have Chrome, you don't have a VP9 codec. That's kind of the issue, is you've got to get the codec somehow.
Right, and Flash got to a point where it was everywhere.
Right.
and then the iPhone came, and then it's not everywhere. But it's still on the desktop, it's everywhere. And so most of the time, for instance, when we're streaming, you know, the end product is going to be a, you know, Flash and HLS. You know, those are the two that, you know, that's, you know, still the standard of how that gets done. And of course, everyone wants to move on. They all know that. But
isn't it Microsoft ultimately that's going to decide this, because they are the dominant operating system, and whatever comes with Windows is going to be what everybody uses? Or is that not the case anymore?
I don't think so. I mean, I think that, I mean, well, if you look at, it wasn't Microsoft that killed Flash, it was Apple.
Yeah, mobile. I mean, mobile is the dominant use case, right?
Mobile is the dominant. Yeah, Rafer's right. Mobile is the dominant now.
So Microsoft says that Windows 10 will come with MKV, that's a wrapper, Matryoshka, as well as all the others, and will support HEVC, which is that H.265. But Microsoft doesn't care about encumbered or unencumbered. They're willing to use patented technologies.
Oh, absolutely. They'll pay for it. They have no problem paying for it. The same with Apple. Apple will pay the licensing fee. And Google will pay for it, too, just so they can include it in their browser. They might not include it in Chromium, but they'll include it in Chrome. You know, Mozilla's been the only one kind of against it.
Wouldn't it be funny if MKV became the default wrapper? All right, let's take a break. I want to talk about Windows 10. I want to talk about Pluto. But first, I want to talk about GoToMeeting. If you have to meet with clients and colleagues, you know nowadays they're not all in the same room. And no client, I'm going to tell you the truth, wants you to fly to them, take them to lunch, have a meeting. That's a waste of a day. They love it when you say, hey, let's have a meeting and let's use GoToMeeting. Why? Because GoToMeeting is as good as face-to-face, but it takes less time, less money, less hassle for them, less hassle for you. You can meet from any computer, any tablet, any smartphone. You set up a meeting almost instantly. It's so easy to click, start a meeting, send out the invitation. They join the meeting very easily. They click the link. The software, if they don't have it, downloads in seconds. And suddenly, not only are you sharing screens with them, but they can see you because they've got this great HD quality video. And everybody's got a webcam now. So now you're seeing the people you're talking with. You're presenting. You're reviewing. You're getting feedback in real time. It's a lifesaver. If you're in business and you're not using GoToMeeting, do me a favor. Try it free right now for 30 days. Visit GoToMeeting, GOTOMeeting.com. Click the Try It Free button. If you do it right now, you can literally have your first meeting up before the ad is done. It's that fast, that simple, that easy. GoToMeeting.com, 30-day trial free right now. GoToMeeting.com. You're going to love it. Windows 10, we excited, we thrilled. I got a call yesterday from a guy who said, I am so sick of this annoying ad for Windows 10 that's popping up in my taskbar. How do I get rid of that? And you actually, it's kind of a complicated thing. There's a hot fix you have to uninstall. Microsoft has put an ad on everybody who's got a Windows 7 or Windows 8 machine saying, sign up for Windows 10 now.
Really?
Yeah. You haven't seen it? You use a Mac.
Well, no, but I actually run a VPN. Not a VPN, VM, a virtual machine.
Yeah, I don't know if it'll pop up in a VM.
On my iMac at home.
I don't know
from time to time.
So, and also fascinating interview with Satya Nadella. You've got to read Mary Jo Foley's story, but he talks a
really
lot about
interview.
This. The decision to give away Windows 10 and all of that.
About time.
But isn't, okay, I agree. As a user, I love it, but isn't that how Microsoft makes a living?
Yeah, it's a challenge because Microsoft's business model is to sell software. Apple's is more or less to sell hardware. Google's is to sell advertising. So it puts Microsoft in kind of a difficult spot. But you kind of have to if you want people to upgrade. And you can't sell an operating system for what they've been selling their operating system for in the past.
Yeah,
although
that's very true.
We have always said that really Windows users never upgrade. They buy a new computer. Mm-hmm. So
but that's the problem is that who needs a new computer? You know, if you bought a computer when Windows 8.1 or Windows 8 came out, right? So that's, you know, 3 years. That computer probably is still decent. You're probably still okay with it.
That's why so many people are using XP.
Exactly. Because the technology hasn't increased to the point where we're needing to do it. We've kind of hit these plateaus. Right. Replacing your phone every year, that's one thing because that's now your primary computer thing. It's like what Ray was saying earlier. You know, like, you know, mobile is now kind of the center of our universe. Our laptops and desktops, not so much. So I think that, you know, if you bought something in the last 3 years, say you bought something a year and a half ago, you know, you bought a computer that came with Windows 8 on it, or maybe by that time it was Windows 8.1, you're probably not going to need to buy another computer for another year and a half, 2-3 years. So it's going to be really hard for Microsoft, I think, unless they give it away for free for the year, to convince people to upgrade. And then if you don't upgrade, then you can't get them into the more virtuous cycle of maybe paying for Office as a service and getting latest updates and all the other stuff. So I mean, they've got to do something.
I love watching, and I think they've got the right guy in charge, but I love watching Satya try to turn this giant tanker. And literally, as they're in, now I'm really mixing metaphors, as they're in flight, change their entire business model from selling software to selling services. And it's a challenge. And I have to say, when it was Steve Ballmer, I didn't think he was solving the problem. And I think, I do feel like Nadella has done the painful things he needed to do.
Nadella's the right person to do it. The question is, can't be done.
Can't it be done?
I mean, and they've got plenty of revenue coming in. They've got a long time. You know, it's not like they're pulling, you know, and they've got a year to figure
this
out.
Well, now's the time to fix it, isn't it?
But this is the direction that enterprise technology companies go from product or software ultimately into services, digital, IBM. And it's actually, to be my perspective, I mean, it might be, it's the right thing. It's the right thing for them to do. It's
IBM and digital, the bastions of computing. We still talk about them all the time, right?
What's what I?
It's kind of sunset. It's riding off into the sunset.
That's kind of my point. That is kind of sad. It's kind of sad to see Microsoft become a services company, which is a corporate, a big corporate play. I mean, they've always been that way. Yeah. And it's, okay.
Do you know what? You have to honor them.
I mean, we put it in perspective, though. IBM is still worth $170 billion.
Yeah. No, I know. They're not.
So it's just boring. It's not as exciting, but it's not like their business is ending.
I mean, when Windows 95 came out, you know, I won't age myself. I was really young. And, you know, there were like lines, you know, stores open at midnight. It was like a humongous event. Rolling Stones were part of it. There are not going to be lines of people to download or get excited about Windows 10. It's not the same thing.
No, in fact, when Windows 7 came out, we had a Windows 7 party. Mm-hmm. They sent out balloons. We had cards. We did it on the air. We had a launch party for Windows. No one's going to have a launch party for Windows 10. It's just going to silently creep under your computer. One day you wake up and it'll be there.
And thank goodness.
Yeah, but they need, I mean, it was horrible.
Microsoft really needs it because Christina's right. I mean, people, if they have Windows 8, they're going to be stuck with Windows 8 until they get a new computer. And when it's time to get a new computer and if they have Windows 8, they're going to be unhappy.
Yeah.
You know, probably. Yeah. So they're going to be looking at alternate platforms.
Ah, that's the fear.
Yeah, they'd be like, let me just get a Mac. Let me get a Chromebook. My dad got a Chromebook.
Chromebooks are great.
Well, it ended up not working out well for him. It ended up kind of dying, whatever. So we ended up getting another laptop. I still can't make him go Mac. My mom is smart. She went Mac. My dad, not so much. But what drove him to the Chromebook the first time was Windows 8. So, you know, we'll see.
Yeah. You have to honor Microsoft because the personal computer revolution would not have happened without a stable, reliable, predictable platform called Windows, and people could develop to it.
And as Nadella said in his interview, which was kind of a dig and also very true, Microsoft Windows, by being open, by having IE be open, or Windows being open, made Chrome possible, which made Google possible.
Yeah, well... And made the cloud possible, made the future possible, and see you later, Microsoft, because the future doesn't wait.
Right.
Oh, hey, thank you. It's like when Ray Kurzweil said, you have to worry about artificial intelligence and robots. They'll think we're their parents. They'll honor us like parents.
That always works.
There's a thousand places where Microsoft was ahead of everybody else and then just didn't do anything with it. I mean, if you look at touchscreens, I mean, they were playing with touchscreens 15 years ago. If you look at Photosynth, you know, they've let go, you know, they kind of let that team go. And now they really wish that, I'm sure that they had a really good VR development tool, you know, and so there's all of these things that they noodled with and produced incredible results and then just flittered it away.
There's a long history of that, though. Xerox PARC invented GUIs but never did it. And that's kind of a tradition. And I think that it speaks to technology in general, that in order to make these big leaps, it takes fresh blood, a fresh look. And that's just how it's going to be. And unfortunately, the business cycle in technology is sped up. In 10 years, you're old. Drones. Good news and bad news.
God. You mean talking about the fire story?
Yeah. Here's the bad news. Southern California, fast-moving wildfire, destroying a dozen vehicles, sending motorists scampering to safety. But the firefighting planes couldn't get there for 26 minutes because... there were drones.
Hobbyist drones flying over, looky-looing.
Looky-looing.
Where's the good news here? So they could. So they had to turn their airplanes and helicopters with flame-retardant material that they were going to dump on burning cars away because they didn't want it to run into a drone.
It's worse. It was the fourth time it's happened this week.
Oh, my God.
This is not good for drones.
Well, no, I think what we're going to see is, I mean, just in the same way that a lot of these drones now are shipping with altitude limiters and so on and so forth that are coming in. I mean, we're just going to see the progression of this is where there's going to be kill switches. And so these helicopters are going to have the ability to push a button, and to any commercial drone, it'll just tell it to drop.
They'll fall out of the sky.
Yep. And this is really, really necessary and really bad at the same time.
Yeah. And not all drones will be equipped with them.
No, the homemade ones won't. I mean,
almost all homemade drones use commercial or off-the-shelf flight controllers, and the software in those, the firmware in those can be programmed. It's already that way. That certain flight controllers won't go near airports in the no-fly zones, et cetera. And making one of those from scratch is really hard.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
we're glad to teach you on know-how with Father Robert Ballesteri each and every week right here on Twit.
What concerns me about this is not that a firefighting aircraft can knock a drone out of the sky, which nobody would agree is a bad thing, but that somebody else can knock a drone out of the sky
right.
when it's, say, it's looking at a human rights issue or a protest or illegal police action. That's the problem, and that's why drones, which are this incredible technology for disseminating information and seeing what's happening and fighting oppression, can actually be disabled by the bad guys.
Maybe there's some hope here because a crew member in one of the firefighting planes saw the drones, mm-hmm. reported it back. They shut down because they don't want to fly. If a drone gets sucked into the jets or hits, even a little drone could bring a helicopter or a plane down. But ground crews tracked down the drone operators and shut them down. So within a half an hour, they were able to get the drones down. Mm-hmm. Now, whether that was a crucial half an hour in this wildfire, as
I don't know how they managed to find them, except for looking for little guys doing this.
Yeah. Well, apparently it's an area where there's a lot of hobbyist drones. I thought initially it was paparazzi drones. You know, how long before Channel 7 News in Los Angeles has its own drone? They got a helicopter.
Seriously. Oh, no, they definitely want them. I mean, it's funny. They're not supposed to have them for commercial purposes, but yet the New York Times has had a number of videos that have very clearly been shot with drones that they've paid for that have gone against the commercial, you know, drone usage thing to get fantastic video shots. So, yeah, I mean, it's only a matter of time.
That's the bad news, but I told you there was some good news. They call it the Kitty Hawk moment. The first time a drone made a delivery, and it was a very critical delivery, medicine to a rural Virginia clinic, a clinic that often has to tell its patients, we're going to have your medicine in a week or so because it's very distant, takes a long time over winding roads to deliver. So the drone took the medicine for the final miles as the crow flies from the airport to the clinic. It's the first official delivery via drone.
This is exciting in rural, you know, Pennsylvania or wherever this Appalachia. It's more exciting in the emerging world in Africa and in other places where getting this kind of delivery system working could really save a lot of lives. You know, it's very interesting.
We have a story on Make right now about a project some guys in Stanford are running to use UAVs, fixed wing, not rotorcraft. Unmanned to deliver humanitarian supplies to Syria.
Awesome.
Interesting what they're doing. The drones are taking different paths each time. They're automated, and if they land, if they go below a certain altitude, if they're forced down before they get to their destination, the electronics fry, so the bad guys can't use them.
Wow.
Yeah. Hopefully really not starting a grass fire.
Yeah. So good news and bad news. Pluto. That's nothing but good news.
Talk about a good drone.
I still
drone.
Say it's a planet. It's still a planet.
It's a planet to me, baby.
Damn it.
Planet to me, too.
You got to love it. 9.5 years ago, we launched a satellite, slingshotted it around Jupiter.
Love it.
Amazing. And it's now sending back. What's that sound?
Pluto.
Is that me? Is that Pluto?
That's Alex.
Alex.
Yes.
I thought this was actually audio from Pluto. I'm sorry. I was getting excited.
Hello.
What's interesting is we had a planetary scientist from the New Horizons project on the new screensavers yesterday. What's interesting is these already beautiful pictures are not the most high-res pictures we're going to see. In fact, it's only 1/50th of all the pictures that New Horizons took. But because it only has a 600 baud modem...
Oh my god.
It's going to take like months before all the data is sent back.
I think they're using Comcast.
No, it's a long way to go. And they can't, you know, I mean, you can't, what are you going to, you can't have a giant transmitter on there. And
they've got a nuclear generator on the thing.
Well, it's a little nuclear. The thing, I didn't realize this, but our guest, Kelsey Singer, I think was her name, told us it's about the size of a baby grand. You know, it's about the size of this table.
Mm-hmm.
It's not big. It's got a little, that's not the generator. That's the whole New Horizons.
Yeah.
It's not that big. It's going on to the Kuiper Belt, but they have some amazing stuff. And I just, you know, it's interesting. For a long time, I think the thinking was, unless you do manned flights, space is not going to get the people's attention. It's not going to be exciting. That's why we have to send people to the moon and Mars. I think the last year has shown some amazing unmanned stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That just the getting the comet, this New Horizons stuff, you don't, it's just exciting as heck. I love it. And Pluto has a heart. It's a frozen heart, but it's got a heart.
I think you get a lot of excitement putting a rover, you know, a remote rover on the moon, you know, and bouncing around. And I think that, you know, it's an order of magnitude less expensive and less dangerous to do that than to put people on it.
Yeah. More and more pictures will be coming. We haven't seen the best pictures yet. So get excited. There's more.
I think there's a year of it, right? I mean, there's like a year.
It's a long time. Yeah, 9 months, something. It's a long time. There's the heart.
We're going to be seeing, we're going to be so sick of Pluto, but no, we're not. This is just amazing. These images are fantastic.
It's just great. It's so exciting. And it's a celebration of,
Did you see the photo of Alan Stern, the guy who, like, this thing was his whole project? And the look on his face, he just had this look of utter jubilation.
His mouth was wide open.
It was so fantastic. It was so good.
He was seeing 9 years later pictures of Pluto. Well,
and they got almost there, and then it lost contact. I mean, there was that moment.
They were like, no.
You've got to be kidding me. It's like, featured. You know, 4 days before it does the thing, they had lost communication, you know, so.
Just the greatest news ever. And congratulations to the New Horizons science team and the John Hopkins University Applied Physics Laboratory. And well done. Well done. Hey, thanks, guys. This was fun. This is a great way to come back. Thanks. We had a fabulous studio audience. They were quiet as mice the whole time. But there are literally about, you know, 50 people here, which is nice. It's really nice to have you. Thank you, Christina Warren, for coming all the way out here via Skype. It's always great to see you at Mashable.com. We still see you every, is it Fridays on TNT?
Every Friday, yeah. I co-host TNT with Mike on Fridays.
Nice.
Sure do.
That's awesome. We'll catch you then. Thanks also to Alex Lindsay for joining us from Pittsburgh. What are you up to these days? I don't see much.
Bouncing around.
You can't tell us, can you?
Well, we do a lot of streams, so I'm streaming. I was down at a golf course we've been in a couple golf courses over the last week, and not a golfing going on, and streaming
in Scotland.
We've got a team in Scotland.
No kidding.
I wasn't there. We provide the ability to watch the Open when you're there. So, we just do the streaming for it. We don't do all the hardware, but the it's a very technologically complicated thing because you want 30,000 people to be able to pick up their phone and actually not have skipping video. And so,
this is the man. What do you use for that? H.264.
Yes, actually.
Flash.
Yeah, so it's the you know, we do the easy part, which is transcoding, you know, encoding, transcoding, so on and so forth. The hard part's really done by a company called Straight Up that has 260 access points, you know, that have to, you know, even out all of the flow and make sure that the app is getting, you know, that you can actually get Wi-Fi. It's a pretty interesting thing to do. As far as, you know, you can sit in the 18th hole and watch the rest of the event, you know, because once you get to the 18th hole, you don't want to give up your seat. But otherwise, you know, it's doing some streaming in Seattle, doing some streaming in DC. And
well, next time you're out here, come join us on MacBreak Weekly. We'd love to see you.
Yes, definitely.
And Skype's great too. We like that. Especially your Skype. Is it 8K? What are you doing there?
So nothing. Good. Look at that. It's just it's a nice camera.
Nice camera.
But outside of that, it's just some lights and you know, a Skype. I do have the Skype, the TX box, which I think.
Oh, do you? Are you using Skype TX?
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
I definitely.
Maybe that's the secret.
There's a secret box.
Yeah, Skype bought a company called, was it Cat and Mouse?
Cat and Mouse, yeah.
That made a special hardware. It made a special PC that would run Skype.
And it was a big PC. It wasn't like a little.
It was expensive. Like I remember that. It's like 10 grand or something.
Yeah.
Skype bought Cat and Mouse, And I think they call it Skype TX. And I guess NewTek, which makes our TriCaster, our switcher, is making a dedicated box. Is that what you're using for the Skype
TX? I use the NewTek one. Yeah. Yeah. And it is. It really makes Skype a lot of fun. it's very, very easy to work with. I think a lot of the complaints that I had were trying to, of course, your desktop version of Skype doesn't really handle
professional
connections anymore.
It's the same codec. It's just kind of the same Skype, but it gives you more controls on it and stuff like that.
Yeah, and it's just very simple to get SDI, HD SDI in and out of it, which is very, very difficult. Yeah. And for some of the studios that we've built, we're now adding them like they get one, and then they go, oh, we want two guests. Now we want four guests.
Yeah, no, we're going to get four. But yeah, they're expensive. Definitely. They're like $5,000 or $6,000. I can't remember.
$4,000. $4,000 a pop.
$20,000. Big deal.
You're using it all the time. You use it every day. If anyone should get
Actually, we talked to NewTek, and we're going to absolutely getting them. Yeah.
Yeah, they're great. Anyway, so I think that's
nice. Thanks also to Rafe Needleman. Congratulations on the new gig as editor in chief of Maker Media. That is exciting.
Yep.
Anything coming up you want to share with us?
Well, first of all, people should know about the website MakeZine. That's MakeZine.com. That's where everything happens every day. The issue that's coming out, that's just beginning to come out right now, is awesome. A former coworker of mine from CNET, Donald Bell, has the cover story. We made a BB-8 with the floating head.
Love it!
Yep.
Did you use a Sphero or did you do something else?
We've actually run, I think so far, 5 BB-8 projects. From everything from the Sphero-based hack with the floating head to BB-8 cupcakes and a bunch of other things.
Well, we're all excited about the new Star Wars, but the BB-8 robot is really the thing that gets me.
And then we're finishing up right now and sending it out soon, the space issue.
Ooh.
That's the one that comes after the BB-8 issue. Yeah, it's really.
Can you make your own Pluto? Maybe.
For you, anything.
I'd like a Pluto.
Yes.
So cool.
And I want Charon as well, or Karen. If I say Karen, people think I want somebody named Karen. I want the moon of Pluto.
Charon. Yeah.
Yeah. All right, everybody. Thank you so much for being here. Nice to kind of get back in the seat. And, it's just like riding a bicycle. I feel like I'm going to fall off. We want to thank everybody for being here. If you want to be in studio, it's easy. Tickets at twit.tv. We love having you. You can, of course, watch us do the show live in the comfort of your own home. Just go to twit.tv/live around about 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern time, 2200 UTC. We'll be here. You can join the chat room and be part of the live action-packed version. Of course, on-demand versions with all the BS edited out are available for download shortly after the show. It takes a few hours to do that at twit.tv, also wherever you get your shows and those great apps. There's lots of them. We didn't write any of them, but there's some wonderful apps available on all the platforms. Make sure you find one, Roku, Windows, phone even, and download it and use it. Thanks for being here. We'll see you next time. Another Twit.
This is amazing. He's in the can.
Thank you. Hey, there they are.
Doing the Twit, baby. Doing the Twit. All right. Doing the Twit, baby.